I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FU Network TV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader. And now, here's your show.
The Broken Clock Podcast returns, and this week we are talking about freedom and the logical underpinnings behind where freedom for a particular individual begins and ends. And this is tied into the ongoing debate about masks. Now, Mouse, I don't know about you, where I live, you can almost predict just by looking at someone whether they're going to be wearing a mask or not. No, this sounds strange because you notice immediately they're wearing a mask, but I tend to notice that there's a particular type of person who is being particularly resistant to this idea of masks. And to me, it seems like they're the ones that are really, really, to look at them, they have bought into the idea of what some would call toxic masculinity, if that makes any sense. And it's not just men. I find interesting, there's a certain type of women who flat out refuse to wear masks as well. I wonder where you are, because you're in a different country, you're in a different, like, sort of, where you live is much more urban. Have you sort of seen the same phenomenon, or are people wearing masks? Are they not wearing masks? What's going on where you live?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I'm going to very briefly recount an incident that occurred to me a couple of days ago. My husband and I went to the local Starbucks because, you know, he has to get his fix. Well, very, very brief context. Before this pandemic started, my husband would go to the Starbucks and program all day. That would be his office. So for years, so the baristas know him, they love him. You know, they greet him by sight in the street, that kind of thing. It's kind of like his cheers. He's the norm of that.
Right, cheers. Right. Okay. Yeah. He's a regular.
Except he's not an alcoholic. He's
right. You know,
he's a beanholic.
Remember when cuddly alcoholism was a television trope?
I know.
Those days seem so simple now.
Yeah. So, when we went to the Starbucks, and we were standing in line waiting for our order, and the atmosphere seemed tense.
Right.
Like something had happened. We didn't know what. There was one of the baristas was checking out of his shift. He had his mask on. Everyone in had mask on. And then this guy erupts from the bathroom. Very, very coarse guy. He had all of the tropes that you would associate with, say.
So it's the same sort of type.
Yeah.
Encounter. Yeah.
And he started disparaging the barista's masculinity, the male barista's masculinity.
That feeds into the theory as well. Okay.
And then he said, you have a loud mouth, you little, so on and so forth. And he stormed out. I asked the barista what exactly had happened. And he told me, well, this guy came in without a mask. We told him we could not serve him without a mask. And he proceeded to scream at everybody. And we asked him to leave. And then he just stormed to the bathroom.
Oh, okay.
And now this is what happened. Now he has come out. Of course, I went out and confronted him. But that's a story for another time.
Right.
But yes, I have noticed when I go to Walmart, when I go to King Supers, when I go to any store, or when I'm walking around, you know, to get, because occasionally we you know, you do need to get out, get some vitamin D,
right,
sunlight. It does always seem to be this type of person. It's hard to pin down exactly what ties them in common, except that their behavior does exhibit that very type of abrasive
machismo. Yeah.
Machismo. Toxic yeah. Masculinity, where they basically go, aha, you are wearing a mask. You are weak.
Yeah. And I bring up women in this context as well, because a lot of women, we talk about men and toxic masculinity a lot, but a lot of women sort of perpetuate this. You have to be a quote unquote real man. You have to be sort of in this box. And that doesn't get a ton of attention either. But I find there's a high correlation between women who have very stereotypical ideas of what a real man is, and the ones who aren't wearing masks. Now, I don't know about you, I've seen a lot more men not wearing masks than women personally. And yeah, I don't want to generalize. It might just be the area I live in that, you know, women are more likely to be in environments where mask wearing is more normalized than the men. I don't know. But it's definitely a thing. And I mean, it comes down to this. You hear, there's sort of two prongs I want to deal with in terms of a critical thinking perspective on this. And I'll start with the one that I'm sure you're going to have strong views about that isn't about freedom per se, but it does connect to it. Certain proponents of mask wearing are making what I believe to be the wrong argument, because they are making a staunchly collectivist argument, which of course has a dual agenda. One, these people tend to be on the left, and so they want to normalize the idea of subverting individual rights for sort of this collective gain. And to me, I think that's exactly, you know, in terms of persuasiveness as opposed to like straight up critical thinking, that's the worst argument you could deliver to somebody who believes, often to their own folly, in sort of this myth of rugged American style individualism. What do you think about that? I know you're not big on collectivism at all, but specifically about using it as an argument to try to persuade people to wear masks.
Yes, it is an incredibly faulty and an incredibly fallacious position, because here's the thing. Actually, there's fallacious positions on both sides, because first I'm going to tackle the rugged in American individualism stereotype. It is no such thing, the way that these men and women are portraying the American individualism. At the very core, at least their version of it, is really not individualism. It is another type of collectivism.
Yes.
Because at the end of the day, it becomes this very, very tribalist, we are here to stop the commies. And, and you know, I am not a fan of communism, and I'm not a fan of collectivism, so I can understand the knee-jerk reaction. But the problem is this. When you look at the core concept of what an individualist should be, these people are kind of falling on the side, not of individualism, but solipsism.
Yes.
Which is, of course, a philosophical position that only you exist, or that only you matter.
And there's so much of that out there right now. And that's different than freedom. Solipsism is not freedom, because freedom acknowledges the existence and value of others.
Right. Solipsism is, at the very core, whim worshipping. My will be done, whether right or wrong. An actual individualist is someone who approaches a situation with the following questions. One, what are my rights in this situation? What are the rights of others in this situation? What is the proper course of action for me to take without infringing the rights of others? Now, of course, the people on the left are essentially sort of trying to erase that equation and basically saying, what is my responsibility to the collective?
Right, as opposed to other individuals, and that's a different mentality.
Right, and the issue, of course, I have with collectivism is that it really is a fallacious stance. There is no such thing as a collective mind, for example. We are not hive people.
People sure try on social media.
Although, yeah, they certainly do. And we must treat individuals as such.
Right.
Now, this rugged American individualism does not account for the rights of others or the consequences of your actions. Because you see, for all the lip service that is paid to liberty in these situations, there is one part of liberty that is being absolutely ignored. And of course, I am of the same mind as take a shot. Ayn Rand's critique of the Libertarian Party, because this is very much one of the few points in which the Libertarian Party has actually influenced political discourse. And of course, because we're in the darkest timeline, it has done this for the worst. Because you see, the reason Ayn Rand never considered herself a libertarian is because she looked at the writings of the Libertarian Party, Rothbard, etc., and she came to the conclusion that although having a political movement that was in favor of protecting liberty was good, you ran into one very, very, very deep problem when you treated liberty as the ultimate axiomatic principle. An axiomatic principle, for those listening, is a principle that you cannot break down into more constituent parts. It is an irreducible primary.
Yeah, right? And I'm really on Team Rand on that one.
And so she said the problems that the Libertarian Party would face come from the fact that they hold liberty as an irreducible primary, and they do not ask, well, where does liberty come from?
Right.
What brings liberty about? So,
right.
Of course, that opens the door for people to say, well, liberty is given to you by the government.
Yeah.
Liberty is given to you by God. And therefore, my religion needs to be present in government, even though it is a contradictory position to the core of libertarianism. You see that in the Libertarian Party.
Yep.
You see that with people like Rand Paul, with Ron Paul.
Yep.
That is the source. What you're seeing there with those crazy libertarians, that thing that Rand pointed out is the source for all of the intellectual gumbo that is there. And I love gumbo. Gumbo is wonderful, but any good gumbo chef will tell you that you need to use key, prime, fresh, and good ingredients, because you can have a shit gumbo, because I have made shit gumbo. Okay?
and the reason it's shit gumbo is so perfect is the way it comes out is actually less pleasant than the way it goes in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is what we have now. So you have this philosophical, intellectual, mumbo-jumbo, completely mixed-up notion of what liberty is.
Mm-hmm. Liberty becomes very illiberal in the hands of libertarians like Rand Paul.
Right, because it does not become a philosophical principle. It does not become, actually, it's not, I would not even call it a philosophical principle. It becomes, liberty is a philosophical consequence of a core principle.
Yes, yes, that's a better way of putting it.
And what we have here is not liberty as that philosophical consequence, is liberty as literally a goddess that cannot be questioned, that cannot be examined.
Yeah, so, instead of it being an outcropping of core principles such as the individual exists, matters, and we can objectively determine its existence.
Right.
Right.
And so you have the standard here, you know, my liberties, my freedoms. Okay, but here's the problem. When you hold that more as a religious, of course, there are many, many religious individuals in this equation that participate in the my freedom, but you also have secular individuals as well. The problem is that this little component here is a little secular religious component.
Yeah, it's the structure of religiosity, not necessarily like a named or recognized religion. Yeah, it's the way people process their thoughts has a religious fervor that is unquestioning and uncritical.
Right, and so that religious fervor has an authoritarian authoritarian component to it, because you cannot have in the way that this is being portrayed, in the way that this is being processed, there is no ground for discourse. It is a commandment. It is a religious moral commandment.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what is far more important for these people is to have their idol, their religious icon be respected and obeyed, rather than to ask important questions. Now, this is not to say that governments in many areas have not overstepped their boundaries.
Yeah, unquestioningly, governments tend to, unless there is a check on government power. Yeah.
Exactly. However, being a religious fanatic is not a good way to check the government.
No.
So the question goes, you know, what is an actual freedom-based approach to this? What is the actual American individualist approach to this? Well, here's the thing. An individualist cannot be ignorant.
Yes.
An individualist, you cannot act unless you have knowledge of a situation. Or, and because I already can hear a lot of people saying, well, you can never have perfect knowledge about a situation. Yeah, as much knowledge as it is possible for you to have about a situation, and it behooves you to look at your sources and to make sure that they're creditable before you act on that information. Because an individual is someone who says, I exist for my own sake.
Yes.
This does not mean that you're going to trample on others, because that is not an individualist. That is a solipsist.
Yeah.
That is a hedonist.
Yes. I mean, the thing I find, you talk so much about Ayn Rand that I've looked into her as a person, not just her writings. And one of the things I find that informs so much of her writing is, even with all her... because a lot of her writing was oppositional to what preexisted, right? And that's what I think a lot of people don't understand. She was taking on the worst parts of Immanuel Kant and John Locke and even Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle. She was adding a yes, but to a lot of those sort of foundational philosophical principles. But
with Kant, it was more like, oh God, no.
Yes, yeah. She took, it's interesting, the philosophers she had the most respect for, she took the most time and focused on dismantling. And, you know, obviously some of the imbalances in Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, I mean, her anti-religion thing, I think, was directly connected to her respect for Aquinas, and yet a lot of, oh God, no, within that respect. She sort of saw how somebody who's clearly very smart and a very good critical thinker was influenced by religiosity to come up with some dumb shit.
But yes.
But as a person, she was very big on manners and cut people off. Isabel Patterson is the big thing. She cut her off for being rude, essentially, for offending. And I think that's a really important element of understanding some of Ayn Rand's writing that doesn't get a lot of time because it doesn't appear, because she was writing oppositionally.
Right. Another thing is that people have to remember that a person's character, as in their personality, not their moral character. You can be an unpleasant person and still be a moral person.
Well, and she was hooked up on amphetamines most of the time.
Yeah.
Later, right? But I mean...
Yeah, the 70s, the
60s. I think it's really telling that manners mattered despite all the, you know, or perhaps because of all the talk about, you know, a person's guide should first and foremost be their own happiness and rational selfishness and rational egoism and all that stuff. Manners really mattered. And that tells me something, because I know a lot of people who aren't sure about the science of it, of masks and everything like that, because they don't understand science, period, and there's too much junk on the internet and they don't trust the news. That's something I'd like to get into, but I'm gonna hold that thought right now. A lot of people, the deciding factor for it is they're basically, well, it's polite, it makes other people feel more comfortable, it's really no skin off my nose in that regard, so I'm gonna do it. And I think that's an interesting thought process, that that's the thing, regard for others. And that's not altruism, that's manners. But manners are the thing that breaks the tie.
Yes, and it's not just manners in and of itself. One thing that people miss about Rand's philosophy is that to have regard and respect for the lives of other people is not just manners, but it's a recognition. It's a recognition of the metaphysical truth of the rights of others. You cannot violate the rights of others and then pretend that yours are inviolable.
Right, because that's inconsistent.
Because that is inconsistent.
Right.
The same rights that protect you protect others. And of course, there are, you could call it exceptions, but not really. When someone murders you, well, when someone murders someone else, you know, they get taken away into prison. Their rights are restricted, but that is because they have already violated. They have initiated violence against someone else.
Well, and they're potentially dangerous going forward as well. I mean, there's rational limitations, right? And that's the thing. It seems like understanding of rational limitations too. And I think you're really on to something in the idea of the people that don't understand rational limitations treat certain principles as fundamental or core principles instead of outcroppings or extensions of core principles. And a lot of people listening are going, what? But it is really an important distinction. Mm-hmm. Because a core principle is, as you said, inviolate. The rights of the individual is, you know, is an inviolate principle. Rights and freedoms are not the same thing. And often they come into opposition with each other. And I find it interesting that some of the places, England and America, notably, that are the birthplaces of so much of this thought through, you know, John Locke and numerous founding fathers of America and things like that. Of course, you know, the founding fathers have that massive contradiction because, you know, Thomas Jefferson wrote about freedom while owning slaves. Technically, his wife owned the slaves, but still, right. He was impregnating them. You know, there's that dichotomy and that contradiction that is sort of undeniable when we look at the lofty language that they used. But even then, every founding father believed in some sort of check on personal freedom. They just couldn't agree on where that check landed. And I think that's part of the problem. The fact that there was that schism, mm-hmm. when America was founded. And so much like when, you know, the various ancient cultures that came together to become the ancient Hebrews and wrote the Torah that then became the Bible, there are compromises in the early books. There are compromises in the Constitution that have been wedges going forward. And it's not just America. It's taken over, you know, sort of the entire Western thought paradigm. And mm-hmm. countries like Canada have sort of gone, nope, we're going to be, these are our lines, because we don't have quite the doctrinaire structure that the U.S. Constitution does. But in the U.S., we do come up against this. We're probably about four steps removed from core principles in terms of how U.S. law is determined, because there's the core principles. The Constitution that was based on core principles that they, you know, stated as self-evident. Mm-hmm. And then we have the lawmaking informed by the Constitution, but then we have the judiciary making decisions on how to adapt those amendments. So that's like 4 degrees removed from core mm-hmm. principles. And I think that's a lot of the problem, because philosophy is not taught in schools, because people are just taught a list of rules that are, quite frankly, rather broad in their statements, because it was written for a fairly homogenous culture that agreed on certain things. People have sort of lost sight of the fact that, you know, George Washington dealt with both smallpox and yellow fever outbreaks when he was a military general, and he quarantined everybody. And in the case of yellow fever, they treated it like a flu or like a cold, even though mm-hmm. it was spread by mosquitoes. Yeah. They didn't wait. They couldn't wait for scientific certainty to enact quarantines. And I think it's strange that these people who are advocating against the removal of monuments to flawed men who helped found America don't know that if they believe so much about preserving history. You know, I mean, everybody says, oh, it's not really about that. We all know that, but
yeah,
we get into this thing of, we know it's not about that, but these people who are arguing against the removal of these statues, they believe it's about that. They really believe it's about the preservation of history. But if, I mean, let's face it, those statues themselves are cherry-picked history.
Yeah.
They're leaving a lot.
And I have my own issue with statues. I don't know if I should go into that here or not. Or
well, it's a, if you can do it briefly, it is an issue of freedom, right? I mean, well, I think I know where you're going to go with it. And if so, yeah, go for it.
Well, to begin with, I don't think the government really should be investing people's money in building monuments and statues. Right. Because, and this is the thing, as you know, my belief is that the government exists only to protect the rights of its constituents mm-hmm. and of individuals in general. To build statues, you know, I think that statues should be commissioned by, you know, private groups, private individuals, museums, etc., and you can right. display them in museums. I think museums are the best place to display these statues because then you can establish the proper historical context. Mm-hmm. But the problem is this: when a government erects a statue, let's say in the middle of a plaza, it is no longer that the same action as, say, of that of a museum or a private institution. It sort of becomes government-sanctioned art,
yeah.
which is, of course, propaganda.
Yes.
And for the government to erect statues of this individual or that individual, you do end up, because people have made these assumptions when they see these statues. Mm-hmm. You know, the government has sanctioned this. This is something that is good and worth celebrating, because that is what people make when they make art, when they make sculptures. It's the artist's recreation of the universe.
Right.
So, of course, if you look at some of the statuary by, you know, Rodin, etc., you can tell what Rodin was trying to glorify when
right.
he would make it. So, but you, when you put that in a government context, that creates an entirely different context, because it is done with the authority of the government, with the money of the taxpayers, and it occupies a public place.
See, I think in a lot of cases, these statues, and we are getting off topic, but I'm going to bring it back in with this. A lot of those statues, I thought, were funded by private groups like the Daughters of the Confederacy.
The Confederacy, yeah.
And that's even worse, because mm-hmm. if it's the government putting these things up, yes, it's propaganda. But if the government is allowing one particular group to push their own propagandistic art, because that's what these monuments are. They are forms of propaganda. They are. I mean, an emancipation statue that has a black man, a caricature of a black man bowing to Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. That says something. That's an ongoing indication that you are free and yet not truly free, right? You are free, but still less. And when the government is not agnostic and neutral about issues like that, when they pick a side, that is direct infringement of liberty for mm-hmm. the majority by the minority. And yep. that's the problem we've got here. That's the individualist argument for mask wearing that isn't being made, that every individual has the right to go to a public place and not get sick, right? Unfortunately, we don't have the greatest tools right now for individuals to protect themselves. So,
well, we know so little still about the virus.
Yeah, and I mean, you can lower your chances by wearing a face shield and a mask, but still, you know, if they cough to the side and it gets in your eyes, you mm-hmm. can still get it. The only way to sort of mitigate the spread of this thing is for individuals to affirm their own individualism by by taking precautions that protect not the collective, but other individuals, right?
Yes, it's like you would say, here's the thing. You will notice that many of the anti-maskers are also pro-Second Amendment. They believe, most of them believe in the right to arm yourself.
They're also using language like my body, my rights.
Exactly.
That, well, being pro-lifers. It's bizarre. And it's almost like they're trolling.
Right. It's not really trolling. That's the sad thing. It is what happens when you have an anti-conceptual mentality.
And
You saw this week. I had a discussion with someone who was absolutely incapable of abstraction. Everything was a concrete phenomenon, completely unrelated to others. So someone who has that type of mentality, who cannot abstract at a higher level than circle, for example.
Right.
They're not going to see a common thread among different occurrences. He will not see the principle in action. The principle in action that ties the mask wearing, the right for you to arm yourself in self-defense, are one and the same. Because first of all, you say, when you want to propose that everybody should be free, you have the original, in case of a government tyranny overthrow, which isn't really valid anymore, because even if you have armed militias and the government turns tyrannical, the government still has an overwhelming arsenal that no militia will be able to
exactly. There's an absurdist element to the Second Amendment these days,
right? Yeah. And but the problem is that in and of itself, while that may be absurd, the principle in action is still valid, I believe. You should have the right to arm yourself for your own protection, but that right carries responsibilities. It carries responsible gun usage responsibilities, gun safety responsibilities, because there is no such thing as a right without a responsibility.
The responsibility is to avoid becoming the thing that other people have to protect themselves against.
Exactly.
And I know that's a huge abstraction, but it's true.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And so you're saying that when you state that you need to have that gun, did you need to have access to that gun? What is the crowning principle here, or the active principle is, just like you said, I should have the right to go into a place, into a public place, and not have my life in danger by the actions of other,
right?
Be it an armed robber, someone with a knife, etc. Okay, we have
also,
that.
There's two principles, though, right? One is the reality of safety. The other is the feeling of safety, and there's slightly different principles, and both are valid. One cannot be truly free. One cannot have liberty when they're living in a constant state of fear.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you have people on this level who are anti-maskers who will agree on the whole. I'm going to say 98% of them are pro-Second Amendment and would agree to the principles that we have just abstracted. Well, let's take a look at the masks. A pandemic. First of all, we don't have a full dossier on this virus.
No, we don't.
New.
Yeah.
We have guesses. We have some studies. We have some studies that are contradicting, saying that 2 meters is a safe distance. Others are saying more. Some people are. There is a contingent of doctors who still hold that the virus may be airborne. A larger number believes that it travels through droplets.
Right.
So you have this going on. Any person who looks at the situation can say, well, first of all, you have people who will say, well, is that proves doctors don't know everything, that they don't know anything. That's not true. What's happening is that we have, first of all, we have a state of emergency where we have medical facilities getting taxed by the number of people in there. Mm-hmm. We do not have a calm and collected research environment where researchers can take time to study the virus at their leisure.
Yeah.
We are in a state where more than 100,000 people have died.
Yes.
This is not just a common flu. This is not dengue. This is not cholera.
Yeah.
This is something much larger. That is an irrefutable fact. The number of people who have died. And even if you don't die, we are seeing reports of what this does to your lungs, what this does to your circulatory system. This is not a virus that many people can just shrug off. Mm-hmm. There are those, of course, who are asymptomatic or very mild symptoms, and good for them. But the problem is that this is not the common case across the board. There are people who are getting mortally sick, people who have, who have been on ventilators for 2 months, who will never have normal lung function again because their lungs are scarred because ventilators fuck you
up. Yes, I wonder too how many people are truly asymptomatic and how many people just don't sort of have the body or situational awareness to sort of recognize. I feel kind of off. I really wonder how many of those asymptomatic carriers are truly asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. You know, I find a lot of people, they have so many aches and pains and just generally feel unwell to begin with that they don't think about it when they wake up one day feeling fluish.
Right.
If that makes any sense. And I mean, some people are self-medicating with so many substances that they're masking the body telling you something's not right. But that's a speculation. I can't
believe
that, but it's to sort of underline your point that we don't know.
Yeah. The one thing that we know is that this virus is very contagious.
Yeah.
That certain situations have proven to be more of a powder keg for contagion than others. Case in point, that choir where one member infected 78 choir members.
Yeah. Apparently indoor dining is exceptionally dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so on and so forth. It does seem to be better in highly ventilated locations.
Yes.
And outdoors where the droplets disperse, or at least the smaller droplets disperse.
Which makes sense, right?
Which
it's not hanging in the air. I mean, I've seen a lot of talk about sick building syndrome and how we need to start taking that seriously because anything where things just hang, it doesn't get like whisked away sort of thing. But the point is, we don't know. There's a lot of speculation going on right now. And the best thing to do is do whatever you can. Because let's face it, if we all sort of do what's best for us, if we engage in, for lack of a better term, rational selfishness, the best thing for me as an individual is if the virus is gone. Mm-hmm. Right? If I take the steps I need to do to get rid of this thing so we don't have to wait for a vaccine, we eradicate it via prevention, that's good for me.
Yeah. So taking all of this into consideration, right? And let's plug it into that Second Amendment framework, because this is how we abstract. We have taken the principles at work, we have taken the information, and now we are going to try and find the common threads between these two. So what is a common thread that would exist within a pandemic and say an unsafe neighborhood? Well, like Ayn Rand would call it a state of, well, not a bad neighborhood. Let's pretend, just for the sake of pretending, that the zombie apocalypse has come in. Mm-hmm. And so you need to have that weapon. You need to have that gun to go out and shoot zombies if they come up to you, or potentially looters and raiders, Mad Max, whatever. Okay.
Yeah.
We're in that level of situation. This is what Ayn Rand would call a metaphysical emergency.
Right.
What is a metaphysical emergency? It is an emergency where normal conditions cannot be resumed, where the state is such that your life is at a constant risk anytime you go outside of a specified safe zone.
Right.
People who live in war zones are under metaphysical emergencies. For example, people who are in the middle of massive natural disasters are living in a metaphysical emergency.
Right.
And what does that mean? It means that conditions are such where your rights and your life are in danger merely by existing in that area. And, now,
go ahead. I'll leave it till the end because it'll be more dramatic if I leave this till the end. Mm-hmm. So keep going.
So if you look at the nature of a pandemic, and what little we know of COVID-19. There are some things that we know, such as the high level of contagion and that it carries a mortal risk for an undetermined number of the population, the causes of which we're still debating.
Right.
So this, the pandemic, turns a person's presence, a person's unguarded, unprotected presence, into the enactor of a metaphysical emergency.
Right.
Your presence, until we have, and this is where I'm pointing this, until we have reliable, fast, and available testing, where you can test yourself and go, oh, okay, I am COVID-free. I can go to, you know, I'm going to go and visit my grandmother, right? Mm-hmm. You can't do that right now.
Right.
You don't have that right now.
Right.
Tests are still available only if you're symptomatic or you believe you have symptoms.
Yeah. Yeah.
So until that happens, you have to assume that you are a potential risk, that you are a potential vector.
Right. Because
you don't know until you start showing symptoms. And when you start showing symptoms, it is already too late because you have been in contact with other people and you are contagious during the non-symptomatic phase.
Yeah. People, anti-maskers, are confusing cause and effect on this. They think that the government is taking away their freedoms when in truth it's the virus that's actually doing it. I mean, it, with a choice of do you go, you know, do you stop visiting granny or do you potentially kill her? There's
exactly.
No choice there, right?
No, there is no choice. And here's the thing. So in this case, we are talking about a person's presence because of unknown variables
yeah.
for which we have incomplete information and therefore we cannot fully act with the full knowledge. Remember what I said about individualism and knowledge.
Yep.
Because we cannot act with full knowledge, knowing that we are not putting the lives of others at risk, the individualist will not take that course of action.
Correct.
The individualist will go, okay, I might have been in contact with someone who has COVID. I might be a carrier.
Yeah.
I need to take precautions so that other people who come into contact with me have a reduced risk of catching it.
Because if you're taking dumb risks, you're no longer an individualist. You are now a nihilist because you don't believe any of it really matters.
It's the difference between for those of you who watch the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, it's the difference between Star-Lord and Gamora.
Okay, unpack that.
Gamora is much more of an individualist than Star-Lord. Star-Lord has all of the outward performative actions of the rugged American individualist.
Right.
But at the end of the day, he is a whim-worshipping bit of a man-child who doesn't care about the consequences of his actions as long as he gets his own satisfaction, which if you saw, I think it was Endgame, Infinity War Endgame, which is the one where he screws up with Thanos.
Doesn't he screw up in every single one? It doesn't matter.
I know, but he screws the pooch big time.
Yeah.
As when you saw, you know, his satisfaction in that scene where everybody is, ready to take Thanos down.
Right.
But he's so focused on knowing what happened to Gamora, even though he could interrogate him afterwards. But it doesn't matter to him. The immediate satisfaction of his needs and his desires is far more important than what stopping Thanos from getting taken down will do to the other people in the galaxy.
And so it steps into the realm of irrational.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But of course, everybody will look at Star-Lord and say, he is the individualist. But no, Gamora is the individualist because Gamora, first of all, she has suffered a lot of personal loss. So
yeah.
She knows what happens when someone who is a whim-worshipping tyrant, like Thanos, for example, is bent on a course regardless of what it will do to others and regardless of what rationalizations they have. Gamora is willing to take the actions that are needed to protect herself and to protect others from this irrationalist individual, no matter what her personal loss is, because she and people will say, well, that's sacrifice. That's not rational selfishness, but that's not true.
That's not true. Yeah.
The notion of sacrifice that, Ayn Rand, take a shot, coined is one I actually like. Her notion of sacrifice is this. Sacrifice is when you give up a greater value in exchange of a lesser value, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for example, let's say my husband is drowning.
Right.
And there is a child rapist drowning right next to him.
Right.
We go back to our old friend. Auguste Comte. Auguste Comte.
Yeah.
In the notion of Auguste Comte's altruism, my moral duty is to rescue the rapist and not my husband, because my husband is a value to me, and therefore that is selfish. Where us saving this child rapist who is drowning at the same time is of a much greater value to the whole, because it's not a selfish value of mine. And if people out there think I am misrepresenting this, I am not. Go ahead and look up Auguste Comte.
No, it's totally true. Yeah.
So Ayn Rand, of course, tied the notion of sacrifice to Auguste Comte's altruism.
Yeah.
But so her focus is this: if you truly value something much greater than anything else, you know, your personal value, you know, right. For Gamora's personal value is that the galaxy and that other people no longer have to suffer what she went through.
Correct.
That no one else should suffer the tyranny of Thanos.
Right.
And for that, she is willing to die because, and this is where the rational selfish part of the equation comes in, because she cannot conceive a universe worth living in which Thanos wins.
Yeah, personally doesn't want to live in that world.
Right. It's exactly the same reason why Cato of Utica fell on his sword when Caesar won. Because he could not conceive a world, you know, he could not conceive a world worth living in which the tyranny of an emperor had outstepped the republic.
Yeah, it's drinking hemlock.
Yeah, and it's drinking hemlock as well. Yeah. So Gamora is an actual closer model of what an individualist, of what an American rugged individualist would be over Star-Lord. And the problem is that more of these people who deny wearing masks and who are throwing these tantrums are more aligned with Star-Lord than with Gamora. And I think the analogy actually works in a way, because Star-Lord's actions screwed over a massive amount of the universe.
Yeah, Star-Lord in the movies just drives me bloody crazy, because I hate the term glorifying, because I don't believe cinema glorifies the way the propagandistic statues do. Mm-hmm. But it's maybe romanticizing.
It is a a romanticism of the man-child.
And it's not giving anybody any rationale to improve beyond being a man-child, because better people than you will always clean up your messes.
Right. And, you know, in that term, I think there are ways that you can start with a man-child and end with a character who has matured but still has a playful side. That requires a very, very good character arc, often a very long one. And of course, you can't really have that in those event movies.
Yeah, it's sort of what Amy Hennig did with the three Uncharted games that she worked on. She took Nathan Drake from a man-child to a guy who's still flawed, but significantly more mature in that he can maintain a primary romantic relationship for more than a couple months.
Right.
And this is something I wanted to get to, and maybe we'll kind of semi-close on this. Since we seem to be talking, this whole conversation seems to be going around abstractions. There seems to be a general issue with people becoming so soaked in postmodernism that they have trouble seeing abstractions as real things. I have encountered quite a few people lately who I think they're trolls, and then I don't think they're trolls, and then I think they're trolls again, and it's like, no, I realize they are so muddled, but it's rooted in an anti-conceptual mentality, but that anti-conceptual mentality is swaddled in philosophical mumbo jumbo, in that they have they can spew concepts of perception. And because, you know, philosophy, you either believe that there is objective reality and only objective reality, there is only sensory perception, we can't truly trust our senses, so it's all perceived. And then there's how Ayn Rand tried to thread the needle on it, saying, no, there is objective reality. We do perceive it through our five senses, but most of the time, those senses are reliable, right? It seems like people who get sucked into this idea of social constructs get reductive in it. That if something is not biological in nature somehow, concrete, then it's not real.
Which and is a biological determinism.
But they don't see it as such. They see it as science. And my late stepfather, who was a scientist, he was a biochemist, would have like just verbally ripped them to shreds over this. Because he was a very cultured man as well. And he recognized that it is important to educate yourself in, I mean, he was a doctor of philosophy by way of biology just because of the naming conventions of it. Mm-hmm. But how you... The rules you set up for yourself, the intellectual rigor that you apply to facts is essential, because a big problem in the sciences is basically attribution fallacies. Mm-hmm. They get a piece of data, they extrapolate and apply the wrong cause to what they're seeing. And I'm seeing so much of this in everything, whether it's our idea of gender, whether it's our idea of, you know, social structures, and whether someone can conceive of particles so small we can't see them as a real thing. Because the virus is a black hole of sorts, right? We can't actually see a black hole.
Yeah.
We see, we infer its existence by the nothingness we perceive, right? There's just this gap in the star field kind of thing, because it's sucking everything in. But we can't actually see a black hole. People who struggle with abstractions are having a really hard time on a lot of points right now. Because, I mean, obviously, you know, the concept of gender identity is an abstraction of a sort. So you can't see into someone's mind.
Right.
And experience their self the way they can. You have to sort of, people think that liking pink or wearing a dress or wearing makeup or keeping your hair long or whatever, that's what gender identity is. No, that's gender performance. And it's the same thing. They seem to be struggling with COVID because not everyone gets sick in the exact same way. It's somehow not real. And the idea of, we're not actually being killed by a virus right now, we're being killed by passivity in thought, aka an anti-conceptual mentality. Mm-hmm. And the fact that various governments via the educational system that they have set up have not taught conceptual development is actually what's screwing us so badly in 2020. Every one of these big issues comes back to the inability to deal with new concepts in a nimble way.
Yes, one of the biggest problems is what is, I don't know if you've seen the neural network model of concept integration.
Yeah.
And so, which is tied to the notion of, you know, neural plasticity, the ability to integrate new concepts into your matrix.
Yeah.
And be able to revise relationships. That is a pretty advanced thing that our brain does.
Yeah.
That is more common and is more frequent in people who are, say, constantly reading new information. Of course, you need to make sure that the information is actually worthwhile, you know, or trustworthy, because you can have a neural network that is full of nothing more than conspiracy theories.
As as Microsoft found out when they unleashed an AI
posting a
15-year-old girl onto Twitter.
And Twitter turned it into a Nazi.
That was that's an example. That's a concrete example of exactly what you're talking about. But
I'm sorry. It was awful and hilarious at the same time. I didn't know if I should feel awful or just hilarious that it happened.
I thought it was hilarious because I just thought it was such a lovely cautionary tale, right? Because I mean, let's face it. There's sort of a bit of a stink on the idea of cultural Marxism or sort of the anti-conceptual academia, the college campus phenomenon, the fact that, and I don't think this is the classes exactly, it's the fact that the big takeaway that a lot of people take from college is not the learning, but the experience, if that makes any sense. And so people... And it's starting even sooner than that. I'm wrong there. It's not college. I'm seeing it in high school.
Oh, yeah.
That everything about the experience of being human is being reduced to a series of transactions. Swipe right, swipe left. Right.
Well, and it's more... So I don't know if you've read a book by... Well, Alvin Toffler's famous book, Future Shock.
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic book because... It was written 50 years ago, 60 years ago, I think, but, or less than that. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember. I'm really bad with dates sometimes, but Alvin Toffler made the prediction that at one point, what would become paramount in human society would not be knowledge, but experiences.
Yeah.
That you would have businesses and even the government and schools selling experiences, which is very much in line with what you've just described, because you don't go to high school, you don't go to college necessarily to be, you know, because I want to be an engineer, I want to be an artist,
which I think is why you should go to post-secondary. I don't think post-secondary should be this mandatory element of development that it is now.
It's the college experience,
yeah,
the dorm, the parties, the friends, the memories that you make forever, as if that is the most important part of your life.
That's the part I hated.
And where the high school experience is enshrined and the college experience is enshrined as this golden hued idyllic halcyon moment that will somehow dictate the rest of your life like it's goddamn 90210.
Which is what I think that's going to be an actual benefit of COVID is we now have a senior year class that was denied, you know, denied junior prom, denied senior prom, denied that graduation, denied those milestones. And those people who had that fairly minor misfortune when it comes to life are going to have to develop additional resilience because of that. And we desperately need that as a people because my God, I'm seeing it burp out in art now and entertainment, the inability to form bonds between human beings seems to be directly connected to a lack of adversity. Mm-hmm. I find people who have to go through serious shit value their human connections more. Whereas people who actually have it too easy and have this intense inner malaise, this intense, you know, something's wrong and I can't quite point it out. But those
affluenza.
Affluenza is one, but I mean, Betty Friedan talked about it in The Feminine Mystique, that women weren't being challenged enough. And so they just had this sense of dissatisfaction that they couldn't quite explain. There's a lot of that going around right now. And it almost seems like I can't point to a friendship, for instance, and make that concrete. Friendship is the ultimate abstraction in a lot of ways. Like, why is this person my friend? Why do I like them? Everything is about networking now as opposed to friendship. So all your social connections are about how either people perceive you as part of a group or what you can get out of that person.
Which is kind of funny because I kind of suck at networking, but I'm more than happy to make friends.
I'm the same way. I'm the same way because a friendship is meaningful, networking to me is anti-individual. Because I am treating that person like a fungible good as opposed to an actual human being, right? I am denying their humanity by treating them as a stepping stone. And I just can't do that.
You're treating someone like a resource instead of cultivating a friendship because you see value in the person. Now, and that's another thing too of individualism. You do not see people as things or resources to use. The whole concept of friendship, really, when it comes down to it, is because you value the value of that person because they bring something to your life that makes that life richer. And if it's a true friendship, it works both ways. It's a win-win transaction, so to speak. But it's a transaction at a different level because when you network, you're taking the utilitarian point
that's
of
right
view. You know, how can I use this person?
Same way when you swipe right, that's a very utilitarian type of hookup,
versus the more, say, virtue ethics side of things, where I value this person because they're a good person, because they're creative, because they have a unique point of view. And all of these things make that friendship so valuable to me. I think my life would be negatively influenced if this person were not in my life.
Yeah. But it's also, let's face it, it's also treating happiness as the prime motivator for life, right? Not collection of goods, not status, happiness. And there's a, you know, people are your friends because of an intangible, because of an abstraction. Something about their presence in your life makes you happier. You tend to call someone a frenemy, not a friend, if they make you miserable and yet you're kind of stuck together for some reason, right?
For some reason.
Yeah. I think that everybody's come into this protective crouch because of a lot of really bad, a combination of sort of treating people like cogs in a machine in a very Marxist framework, combined with the cronyism of metastasized capitalism. Mm-hmm. Not true laissez-faire healthy capitalism, but the cronyism, the artificial picking winners and losers that we've got.
Which exists only because there is a statist framework currently in the government that enables that.
Right, because it's not because the higher principles of government are not being treated as inviolate by the governments themselves. Mm-hmm. And this is where I get into the idea of societal abstractions, of social constructs. They're real things. They are created, much like a table or a chair is manufactured. But they are real. They impact our lives. And it's almost like social contract theory has gone so haywire that it's not even a social contract anymore. Because the table, the chair, the car does not enter into a contract to be produced. They are the output of that contract. We are no longer the worker in the factory. We are the car. And we're acting, you know, individuals are acting accordingly. All they do is go vroom when someone puts a key in and turns it or presses a button. There's no higher purpose. There's no higher striving because people aren't being encouraged in that direction. They're actively being discouraged. And it's interesting because I have a few friends who they're Canadians or they're Americans, but they're of Asian descent. And they've talked to me a lot about the fights they have with their parents because, you know, they wanted them to have a Western education. They wanted them to have the best education possible. So, of course, what did they get taught? Individualism, philosophy, you know, higher principles. Mm-hmm. And then the parents don't like the free-thinking young adult that education produced. And it's so interesting and it's so humbling. It makes me sort of appreciate because it's really trendy to sort of be down on the West right now. But when you talk to people who came from places that didn't have that philosophical underpinning. They treat it as precious. They treat it the idea that the individual matters and you're not just an extension of your family, your company, your country, you know, your species. The idea that the individual matters is so precious to people who are the first generation of their family to experience it that they will fight for it.
And they often make better individualists than people who may have grown up here and have grown up with a Star-Lord version of individualism.
They understand it. They don't take it for granted, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why ultimately I think privilege is actually a bad thing. It makes you weak. This is why I think the right word is privilege and not advantage, because an advantage actually benefits you in the long run. It is an undeniable positive. Whereas privilege, oh, you may get along easier, but it actually lessens your capabilities. It weakens you. It atrophies your potential in a way that is ultimately not good.
That is true, but I think that the core, see, privilege, having those advantages would not be to your detriment. If you grew up in a society where things like philosophy and critical thinking were valued.
Correct.
So that you would not become fungible with your living situation, so that you would not be essentially, that you would not be able to see only how you grew up, but you could actually apply critical thinking to your situations versus the situations of others and realize that, A, for example, you are in a place, that you grew up in a place of privilege, that you have these things available to you, but not everybody has them. And to treat other people as if you expect them to have had those and then to, say, berate them for not having that is irrational.
But critical thinking also undermines privilege in a positive way. And that's the thing. If everybody thinks critically, then they don't have the blind spots that privilege creates. They recognize, they can see past petty bigotries. They can see the other as the self through logic, even when all those, you know, programmed emotions are screaming, danger, danger, this person's not like me.
Right. And it works on the opposite way as well.
Yeah.
If you grow up in a disadvantaged position with hardships, and let's say you had the misfortune of growing up in a very violent environment or an incredibly insecure environment, there is a chance that if you do, you know, that even after you manage to make life better for you, that you're still operating in the modes in which you grew up and that you're carrying the assumptions that you grew up with, which no longer apply to the situation that you're in and which can cause complications for yourself as well. So it works on the opposite end of the scale too. Both privilege and incredible adversity can in many ways influence your way of looking at the world and your way of reacting to other people in a way that is, you know, not optimal and which will cause problems both for you and for others.
I think a shining example of that is Black Men in Masks, going full circle kind of thing. Even though it's not ideal health-wise, I totally understand why there is a hesitation. And I thought it was really beautiful that you saw, you know, the Black Lives Matter protesters, all those marches, they were all in masks because there was an early fear that more Black men would get killed for being treated like a potential threat because the image of a masked Black man has a particular symbolism in our culture. Mm-hmm. And I admit, I judge less harshly when I see Black guys not wearing masks than when I see anybody else not wearing masks. And maybe that's a problem on my end. Maybe I should be going, well, you're all being irresponsible. But I do give them a lot more leeway that way. Because again, they're having to weigh two threats to their own life as opposed to just one. You know what I think? The calculus is different.
And of course, the problem, the real unacceptable part of that equation is that they have to weigh those two threats at all.
Exactly. I really think this whole pandemic is really, I mean, we've been a million different directions in this conversation, and I think that's telling because sometimes you go down a rabbit hole and you realize I think this discussion has kind of indicated the problem isn't the disease per se. Mm-hmm. The problem is the societal weaknesses that the disease has highlighted.
Right. If you had a, if you have a society whose core, at the very, you know, very core, even if it's vague enough as it is a rational philosophy, a rational outlook, what we're experiencing would not be a thing.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we don't, and so here we are.
Yeah, I mean, Rome didn't really fall because it was sacked by, you know, the barbarians at the gate sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Rome fell because it overextended its supply lines. Mm-hmm. It expanded too quickly, too far, and collapsed accordingly. So did the Soviet Union. And, you know, this might be the thing that stops the great call or delays. I don't think any culture can last forever. But right. COVID responded to effectively will prolong the success of, you know, Western society, for lack of a better term. And by Western society, I mean the ideals that Western society is based on, not, you know, Starbucks and Amazon mm-hmm. kind of thing. But that's a discussion for another time. We may have to do another two-parter here about a lot of the things we dredged up. This
I think we might.
Yeah. If people wonder why we tend to use like news items and things like that, it's to avoid these abstractions. Because if you've been listening and you've been like, what are they saying? What? I can't follow, because this was a highly, highly technical podcast. And like for some people, I think they're getting like brain crack right now. But for other people, they're probably lost. And that's why we tend to use examples, because this is important stuff. It's very, very complex stuff.
Right. And, you know, I want people to understand one thing, that there is no shame and there is no condemnation in not being able to follow, you know, higher levels of abstraction, because I'm going to be honest, you know, your schools have not prepared you for it. This is something that people have in many ways. Here's the thing. The world is very, very challenging, very difficult. And while past societies allowed us to prepare for it by providing us physical means of defense, our current education system has left us defenseless.
Yep.
Against the much higher threat that is bad thinking. And it's a much higher threat because there are things such as biological weapons, nuclear weapons,
yeah.
economic forces, things that can be tossed into a maelstrom through bad thinking, bad philosophy. It takes is one head of state to be the absolute embodiment of the abandonment of abstraction and rational thought and principle to throw the entire machinery into a seizure.
Yeah.
So what do you do? How do you arm yourself? Well, here's the thing. Fortunately for us, we do live in a society where there are many, many resources at our fingertips. Some are expensive, some are cheap, some are free.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to make the plea to people who think that abstraction and principle are not important because, quote, they are made up.
Yeah.
I want you to understand that technically speaking, you could say it is made up because they're functions of the brain, but abstractions and principles are nothing more than higher level thought processes
yep.
that are underlined by a connection to the real world.
Correct.
Abstractions that have nothing to do with the real world are called floating abstractions, and they yep. have, you know, they're absolute wah-wah. They don't matter. But the problem is this: when you abandon that process of abstraction, you're working on an exclusively perceptual level,
yeah.
But you don't have anything that is guiding the filtering of your perceptual level except emotion and reaction.
Yep.
And that is how you end with self-contradictory positions that in the end will cause chaos and strife in your life, in the lives of others. Look at the president. He is the poster child of self-contradictory, of a self-contradictory life that has abandoned that higher abstraction process. He works at the purely perceptual, purely reactive level.
Yeah, I mean, that's why the founding fathers of America went with representative democracy instead of direct Athenian democracy. They saw how it descended into the mob. And, you know, unfortunately, now people are acting like we live in various Athenian democracies, mm-hmm. where, you know, the group can ostracize people who are anomalous or contradictory. And we don't want that world. You know, if people really believe in the freedoms outlined in the founding documents of America and other places, we have to truly accept that a great threat to individual freedom is the mob, is right. mob rule.
And you can't really get to that point until you understand the framework. Because it's fine to say, yeah. oh, the Constitution, this and this and this and this, but if you do not understand the framework that went into the drafting of that document, even with its, you know, all of the infighting and contradictory statements that still happened,
yeah.
if you say that you're interested in liberty, that you're interested in protecting rights, that you're interested in all of these things, it behooves you to look into the humanist framework that went into the founding of this country. In the humanist, for example, you know, go ahead and read the essays of the Marquis de Condorcet, mm-hmm. who was the greatest man in the Enlightenment, because while other the founding fathers themselves were self-contradictory, etc., the Marquis de Condorcet did not allow religion or any other social bias to get into the rational application of the principles behind the Enlightenment. So he not only was an anti-abolitionist, for mm-hmm. example, he opposed slavery fervently, he opposed monarchy, he opposed women not having the vote. He considered women as worthy of having the same rights as men. This was a man of the Enlightenment. That is the true essence of the Enlightenment and critical thinking and abstractions, because he reached all of those positions by starting from a concrete and trying to abstract and trying to tie things together and saying, okay, well, if I have these rights, why does not this person who has a different color to his skin have the same rights? Or does he? Does he have the same rights? Etc.
Do you notice that a lot of the most consistent pro-women thinkers of the Enlightenment were mathematicians?
Yeah.
Because Lewis Carroll as well, right? I mean, he writes in Female Persona. It's interesting because they are formulaic. They are systemized thinkers. And so they think in equations.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, if there's any advice I can give, is that you need to start looking into how to form abstractions, how to identify abstractions, the underlying principle of things, and more importantly, epistemology is yeah. most important of all, because you can say, okay, well, this is the principle that I see here. This is the abstraction that I see here. But then if you go and make conclusions out of that, you've missed the most crucial step of all, mm-hmm. which is where epistemology comes in, yeah. where you ask yourself, how do I know that this is true? What yeah. tells me that this is true, and how can I find out if this is true? These are the things that make the individual. These are the things, for those of you who use this type of language, these are the things that make a man and a woman. These are the things that make the adult man and the adult woman. We live in a society that has infantilized us through yeah. lack of critical thinking, through lack of higher abstractions. We have become a society of instant gratification and sensory input and output, but we are abandoning the higher functions of our intellect that allow us to process and to gain greater meaning from those things. When we are reduced to that, we are children.
Mm-hmm. Because we short-circuit the process of I doubt, therefore I think, therefore I am, by avoiding doubt.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is why the tagline of the Broken Clock Podcast is what it is. That's a good place to wrap. Do you like how it came in for a landing that way?
I think so.
If you like this kind of stuff, man, this content doesn't monetize well, but become a patron, buy some merchandise. Everything can be done through funetwork.tv. And like I said, like I always say every week, thinking is good for you, even when it hurts sometimes. Mouse, you get the sign off.
Oh gosh, I've said way too much. Go ahead and look up some abstraction stuff, people. Think.
This is fun! The FU Network! This is fun! The FU Network!